This is Poured Over, a show about stories presented by the booksellers of Barnes & Noble.
I'm Ewa Messer. I'm the producer and host of Poured Over, and Cullum Tabeen has been on the show before, actually, for A Guest at the Feast, which was an essay collection a couple of years ago. And in that interview, Cullum said, oh, by the way, I'm working on a new novel, whipped out a notebook, held it up to the screen, and it turns out, well, it was Long Island, which is the sequel to Brooklyn. It is his latest book. I am so excited to have this conversation, but we are spoiler-free, obviously, because there is so much to discover. But all right, you and I were chatting right before we started taping, Cullum, and you said, well, ask me what I was teaching just before I started writing Long Island. And I would very much like to know, because I think there are a lot of threads here that come back to earlier work and all sorts of stuff.
There are a number of books. I mean, there may be other books that I just don't know yet how they made their way into this. But for me, teaching is reading. In other words, I won't go into the classroom unless I myself have read the book in the previous few days. So all the details are fresh in my mind. And then, of course, with the students, we go over the book in such detail. And some of it is quite technical. In other words, we don't come in with a theory. We imagine the book unwritten, and then we begin to see how it might have been composed. So the first thing is that I'm speaking to you now from my office at Columbia University. Two doors down is the office of a man called Edward Mendelsohn, who also teaches here, who's a professor. And he wrote a book of essays. And in that book of essays, he has an account of what plot is. He just casually says, you know, and plot. And then he just stops. Being a professor, he just stops and says, what is plot? And of course, I become interested as I'm reading his essay. And he says, plot is not an action. Plot is an action and its consequences. And the consequences need not be a pattern. They can be stray or strange. So I read this and think, plot, consequences. And then among the books I'm teaching would be, for example, The Mayor of Casterbridge by Thomas Hardy. Now, in that book, it opens with a man walking into a town. He's got his wife with him. What he does at the fair in that town is he stands up on a table and puts his wife up for sale. He says, yeah. Who will buy this fine woman? And there's a quiet man, handsome at the back, you know, secret and funny. And he just puts his hand up, I will buy. Now, when you read this, you think, no matter what is going to happen, there are going to be consequences. And you think, this isn't just an action. It is an action that requires consequence, even if the consequences will be much later in the book. And so you read the book, even though many other things are happening, you realize, this first action has to come round and come out. So I become interested in this idea of starting with something that is just, no matter what you do with it, it will have consequences. But I don't keep a diary, I don't keep notes, but at a certain point, the image for the opening three pages of Long Island came into my mind. And the minute it came into my mind, I welcomed it because I knew what I could now do. I had my beginning, as in The Mayor of Casterbridge. I had that beginning, there was just a big bang of a beginning. One of the other books I was teaching was Joseph Conrad's novel, Victory. And everybody knows Nostromo, people know Lord Jim, but Victory, for me, is the great Conrad novel. And it is a novel in which I'm not making this up. Every single action, almost, is told twice from the perspective of two sides. So you have people arriving on the island, and then you have the people on the island watching the people arrive on the island. And it's really difficult to do, but it's really rich because you, the reader, know already, but you're seeing, oh my God, this is how they felt. And I thought, don't do this all the time in the book, but do it when you need it. In other words, twice or three times you get it. And it's surprising, but it has to mean this is important. This is an important scene. So important that one perspective will not do. You need to show it. How did someone else view all that? And I was also teaching The Golden Bowl by Henry James, which is James's last big book written in the early 20s. And in that book, it's filled with images of secrecy. Who knows what and who doesn't know what? So that Maggie, I'm giving the plot of the Golden Bowl away, by the way. Maggie knows that she doesn't know, but the reader sort of does, that her best friend, Charlotte Stant, is having an affair with Maggie's new husband, the prince. So she doesn't know that. The reader knows that. When she finds that out, she doesn't let Charlotte know that she's found it out. So Charlotte doesn't know that Maggie knows now that Charlotte's having an affair with Maggie's husband. Maggie's father, Adam, never knows that any of this is happening. So there's a number of secrets being kept. And the other book is Edith Wharton's The Age of Innocence, which I wrote an introduction to as well. And in that book, of course, you do have the idea of an exotic outsider arriving in a closed community and the exotic outsider coming to the attention of a man who is about to marry. You don't deliberately take a plot, but you find that little things start in your mind and you realize, oh, you know, what does an engagement mean? And I think engagements, have, at least in New York or Dublin, have died out. But engagements were very important because they were often long and they were often secret. And, you know, it was much more important in a way than a wedding was the announcement of the engagement ring and the showing of the ring. And so all of those things, you know, how can you write a long engagement novel now? Well, the answer is Ireland in the 70s, because I was there, I know. People got engaged and the engagements were long. And so you could work with that. So there are just a few of the books, but obviously everything I was reading made its way into this book. And also then, of course, more than anything, imagination.
One of the things that I love about your work, and I've been reading you basically since the heather blazing in the South. So I've been reading you for more than a minute. And the Blackwater Lightship is certainly one of my personal favorites, as is The Master. I mean, you just have this incredible body of work. But consequences are something I always think about when I hear your name, that you are always writing to consequences and that there is a level of silence that you allow your characters in the story to experience that not necessarily everyone would. And you've talked about this in other interviews where you've said, well, actually, it's really that tension between concealment and revelation, right? And wow, Long Island, this novel, I knew you had written the sequel, obviously, and I really tried to go into it reading blind because I was wondering what had happened to Eyeless. And then I realized you've set it in 1976, and there isn't a ton of fiction set in the 70s, which I'm hoping folks will address, because I think it's a really fertile period for lots of different communities. And wow, that opening. I don't think it's a spoiler to talk about the opening and what you do to Eyeless.
First three pages. I mean, you can't.
You can't. So, and you said it came to you all in one go.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're airing on your pub date. So would you just open up the story with sort of the very basics of what happens to Eyeless and kicks us
that
off?
What we want first is about three paragraphs that give you some sort of sense of domestic bliss. That there's a woman, she's called Eilish, and she's in Long Island, and she's waiting for her two children and her husband to come home. So in other words, she's home. It's about maybe 3:30 in the afternoon. It's probably the spring. Her mother-in-law seems to be living just across the lawn from her in those sort of suburban houses. It is a place called Lindenhurst in Long Island. And her mother-in-law visits and they seem to have a friendly conversation about nothing much. And her mother-in-law seems very sweet and interesting and funny and they make jokes. And then it seems that there's a man looking for Eilish, but obviously she thinks it's because it's something to do with her husband's business because he's a plumber, her husband. And so when she just started to think, as a lot of us do, maybe I'll have a cigarette. People have given up cigarettes, you know. And then she said, no, I won't. And then she knocked to the door. She thinks there's somebody for her son. And then she goes to the door and there's the man who's been looking for her. She can see the silhouette and she opens the door and he is Irish. And he's Irish in a different way than she is because she's from Wexford, which is the southeast. And his accent sounds Donegal to her, which is the north. Big man, he's imposing and he looks at her and says, are you married to the plumber? And she thinks insulted, whatever way he says it, it seems to. And she grows very careful. And he then says how marvelous the plumber was, what a great plumber he was. And adds, so good, in fact, that my wife is having a baby in July or August. And I am not the father. And your husband is the father. And if you think I'm keeping the baby, I'm raising the baby with my own children who are conceived, you know, in the decently, as he says, I won't. I'm not. So as soon as this baby is born, I'm bringing the baby up here and I'm leaving it here. I'm giving it to you. Deal with it. And what she's trying to say to me is get back to small talk. You know, what part of Ireland are you from? Just to see if there's a way of stopping this you know, tsunami of shock. And just goes back to his truck and then turns one more time to her and says, and you tell your husband if he ever comes near my house again. You know? And then he just disappears and she's on her own. it seems for some time, but actually it's probably not more than, you know, 40 minutes. And she walks around the house, this suburban house, you know, it's three bedrooms upstairs, a living room and a kitchen, dining room, kitchen come dining room. And it seems as though everything in the house seems new or seems strange or has to be touched. And she doesn't know what she's going to do. She's, in fact, we see so isolated in that way that she goes to the phone and just picks it up because just to hear a dialing tone, to imagine there's someone, but there isn't. And so that's what the novel then has to deal with. In other words, I've set up a problem, and the rest of the novel will, in a way, I've set up an opening bang, and I have the rest of the novel, then all the smithereens, all the shrapnel, all the stuff coming out from that. We'll try and create a pattern for it or some sort of drama. And as I say, consequences.
Consequences, but starting with isolation, does Eilish even know how isolated she is until this happens? I don't think she does. And we learn a lot about her in the course of this novel, which moves very quickly. I mean, I remember lingering, and the chapters are longer in Brooklyn. You've structured the novel slightly differently. There are multiple parts. I think there's six or seven in Long Island, and there are four in Brooklyn, and the four sections are much longer. But the way this story moves was really unexpected for me.
Oh, really?
I thought you were going to sort of let things sort of unfurl a little more slowly, but I'm very happy with the way you paced everything. Because I could not put this book down.
And the idea is this is April.
Yeah.
Well, you know, her daughter is going to go to college, and she's really going to go in early September. And so really the end of August is the cutoff point. So it really is a novel that occurs over one summer. And once you have that, it gives you all sorts of deadlines and ways of approaching things. The first, the structure is as follows. I'm not giving anything away. But the first section, which is the longest, is entirely from Eilish's her perception, from her perspective. And then in the rest of the novel, there are three sides to the story, each in each section, three people, one of them being Eilish. But so that we get her full story, so you get her. I wanted to give you a real sense of her, because she, as you say, she doesn't feel isolated, because this really has been a way of being happy. In other words, this is what they wanted. They wanted to be together, herself and her husband. This is in Brooklyn. And the family was going to move out from, you know, very cramped quarters they were living in, Tony's family. And they were going to move out and have gardens and have lawns and have, you know, very good bathrooms and kitchens and stuff. And so they have four houses, which they built themselves on greenfield sites as Long Island's expanding in that way. And they have, so Tony is in one house with Eilish, his wife, and his two children. Then his two brothers have a house each. And then Tony's parents, including the very formidable. And that, you know, she's not an ogre. She's not a witch. She is someone who lives in the Italian way in Long Island. In other words, she loves her Sunday lunch with all the family, all the children at the main table. But she also just notices everything that her daughters-in-law are doing. She has four sons, three daughters-in-law. Of course, everyone's trying to find a husband for the fourth son, Frank. You know, the whole point is that you suddenly realize that Tony has his brothers, Tony has his parents, you know, living nearby, and Eilish has no one. You know, that she moved out to the suburbs, she spent all her life, or, you know, those 10 years raising her children, and the children are marvelous. And so everything's been good, except you realize that she has really no friends, no peer group, and also that it's intellectually stifling. Whatever it is emotionally, it's intellectually stifling because she is really curious. She's curious about things. She would love a big moment in her life is that she starts getting the New York Times on a Sunday. And I remember this happening in my house in Ireland to my mother. My mother started to get in sometime in the late 60s, she started to get the Irish Times every day. And she would devour it. She would read all sorts of articles on including on, you know, foreign policy matters. This newspaper gave her a sort of life. And this happens to Eilish. So, but she has, which I think happened to a lot of people who went to live in the suburbs, that it all seemed fine until it didn't.
I think that's the American dream for a lot of folks. I mean, for years and years and years, we presented it. This is the ultimate. You get your house and your lawn and your freedom and your space and everything else. And it never quite works out that way.
Well, it works out for the men in the sense that we always find, you know, friends and brothers and family, but for her also that she's the only Irish woman among them, and they know nothing about her. They know nothing about who she is or where she comes from. So it's almost like that she's a ghost sometimes at the table or a ghost in the room with them. By the way, there's something else I really need to say, that I hate sequels, and I promised I would never write one. If you're like, why is there such a big distance? I mean, more than like, what, 12 years between Brooklyn and this, is because I had no interest, no intention. I never thought about it, writing it. It was only when that first image occurred to me.
Okay.
And I have a story. It's not a sequel. It's a story. But it is a sequel, and it's got the same characters. But it wasn't something I ever planned.
But I will also say you don't have to have read Brooklyn in order to appreciate Long Island. I think that we have to be very clear about that. It's great if you have read Brooklyn, but at the same time, you will not be missing out on anything if you just pick up Long Island and go cold with it. There are some characters, though, the majors and the minors. So obviously, Eilish's mother. The older women, Francesca, Tony's mother and Eilish's mother, are both women of their generation and their respective sort of communities. And watching them sort of maneuver in the world around their children, and their children are trying to, you know, do the next thing and figure out what they want. And I love both of these women. I am very glad that I can leave them in the novel. With all respect.
Yes. The big change between Brooklyn and this novel, Long Island, is that Eilish's mother has had 20 years living on her own, having lost one daughter who died suddenly. Her three sons have gone to England, and her other daughter, the most loved one, has in the strangest way possible, has fled to America. And the mother over the 20 years changes. She becomes quite angry and manipulative, but she changes again, because when the grandchildren come from America, she becomes this sort of loving, adoring, sweet woman again. But you can see the amount of pain Eilish's exile has caused her.
Both Francesca and Mrs. Lacey, though, they just don't have options. They really don't. I mean, we're watching Eilish sort of develop lots of different pieces of her life, and she's not the only one. She's got an old classmate who pops up as well. And watching these sort of younger, middle-aged ladies, right, work their way through, and they're watching their children, and their children are a little alien to them as well. It's having all of these generations fishbowl might not be the right word, but it is a little bit of a pressure cooker, because they're all just, they really do all love each other, but they
all love each other.
Know how to make sense of what's happening. And it's fun for us as the reader, but one of the things I was thinking about as I read Long Island is Nora Webster's name pops up. And there are plenty of readers who will know that Nora Webster is your 2014 novel. And it is, I don't know, is it fair to say that it's the novel that most closely sort of resembles your family's personal story?
Yeah.
I mean, Nora Webster has quite a lot of your mom and your dad and you and your brother. But when Nora pops up, Mrs. Lacey, and obviously if you've read Nora Webster, you know Mrs. Lacey also pops up briefly in Nora Webster. But seeing that mention of Nora sent me back. And you've got that line about how marriage is the thing that actually sort of saves Nora from this fate, this world she doesn't want and this job she doesn't want and all this kind of thing. And watching the relationships unfurl and evolve in Long Island, you know, this idea that a relationship is the thing that you want, whether you're a man or a woman, like the relationship is the thing. That's the goal in a way. And I'm like, oh, that's how I know I'm reading something that really isn't present day, right? Like, do we even think that way anymore? Like, it's of a moment.
Yes, I think the important thing about that particular idea of Long Island is that it's the 70s in which the 60s have not really occurred. So in other words, there's nobody listening to the Rolling Stones. You know, that these people have, just say they married in the 50s and they went into their houses and they really devoted themselves to domestic life. And there is an argument about the Vietnam War in the book. I mean, it is an important moment for it. It's when she realizes how opposed to the war and how in favor her father-in-law is. But actually, in the culture, for example, her daughter is not affected by youth culture. You know, she's... And so in other words, you have a sense of it being enclosed. as though it's the 50s, but is, of course, a time of much larger opportunity, which, you know, you can fly to Ireland, which in the 50s you couldn't do. This happened in Ireland, and I know it happened in America, where there are places where those things did not impinge. I mean, long hair. There is one reference to long hair that one of Tony's brothers does have, but long hair that didn't seem, you know, the generations didn't break. It isn't as though Tony and his brothers began to despise their parents, which people did do in the 60s. They don't do that. They're an Italian family, and they've moved out to the suburbs. So these things are quite important, that just because it's the 70s doesn't mean a whole set of things that people might associate if you've lived in a metropolis in the 60s. This is not a metropolis.
Oh, no, it's not. But it is still radically different from the place that Eilish has come from. I mean, and not just Brooklyn. I mean, you send her back ostensibly for her mother's 80th birthday and the celebrations and to see her brothers and put her into a bit of a situation. I think she's really shocked by how much of an outsider she is. And I mean, she's been gone for 20 years and yet she's still surprised. And she's surprised by her mother's response to her return. And she's surprised by some other things that she learns while she's there. And watching that surprise was really interesting to me because I was surprised at her surprise. I was just like, Eilish, you've been gone for 20 years.
What she's surprised by most, I think, is the effect she has on people, because that's not intentional. She isn't as though she dresses up like an American in posh clothes to go home. She just wears what she normally wears, but they're all looking at her and they're watching her suntan. There isn't even, I think, a mention of her teeth, but it would be that there's a whole set, her wrists. Nancy noticed that her wrists seem to be very slim. But she has no sense of that. So the whole way that she moves and dresses, and she does it, and it is clear that she's a very elegant person. And her mother cares so much about what hat she's going to wear to a wedding. But there's no, she doesn't really think, I am the belle of the ball. She's not that sort of person. So that's the first big shock, that how people deal with her. But I suppose also she's put no thought into it. She's put it out of her mind. You know, the one thing I wasn't going to have in the book, and I could have had, because it's something I do. I listen to Irish music sometimes. My partner, my boyfriend, says, oh God, he's listening to Irish music. He's going to, you know, come in all melancholy. I don't cry or anything, but I do get, not homesick, but just something. I didn't want to give her that, because that would be too easy as a way to just, it's like a shorthand for homesickness. She doesn't think about Ireland as an entity, as a political, she does think about the civil rights movement and the troubles in Ireland, but not, she doesn't think, Ireland, I'm Irish, I miss Ireland, I want to go to St. Patrick's Day Parade. There's no mention of St. Patrick's Day Parade. So that she has moved out of that idea of being an Irish person. And suddenly she's back in, sometimes she's back in her own bed. You know, in her mother's house, her mother has no interest in her for a while, but wants to go on the street with her so that everyone can say, this is my daughter home from America. So she's got all those problems again about being paraded around as the Yank who's returned. And of course, she has a rented car that no one...
Which is...
No
flashy.
One, I can tell
flashy.
You, no one would rent a car for longer than it was entirely necessary. And the idea that she's rented it for all her stay,
yeah,
and it's outside the door, and everyone in the town is looking at.
One of the things that I really felt for Eilish, she's got a lot of folks who are attempting to make decisions for her while she figures out what she wants. And I may have made some notes in my galley that were slightly pointed at the people who kept trying to make decisions for her and not listening to her. And that is such a universal moment. Not just, I mean, whether it's as her role as a mother or wife or a daughter,
yeah. Yeah.
It's just people kept projecting onto her and just saying, well, of course, I'm just trying to make you better. I'm just trying to give you what I think you need. And her frustration, I'm like, how are you doing this? And then I remember we're in 1976.
What I started to work with was that I put a lot of energy into her speech. So I give her almost a lawyerly way, almost like a lawyer might, asking people, how long have you known A? and waiting for the answer. So she, while she's passive, while she's easy to push around, she suddenly develops in, I think there are three, but two big moments in the opening of the book, one with her mother-in-law and the other with her brother-in-law, who's the lawyer, where she out-lawyers him in a meeting in his office. She asks him, she really embarrasses him. So that is this right. thing we're watching someone of who has real intelligence trying to maneuver, and she's outmaneuvered, and then she maneuvers all about the politics of family life.
And she does it without the most formal education. I mean, she's who she is. I'm not the first person to say this, but obviously readers bring their own stories to any novel that they're reading. And there were moments where I had to stop and say, hey, wait a minute, no, this is not 2024. You know, my experience of the world is so radically different from hers. And yet at the same time, there were enough moments that you pepper through where I'm like, oh, right.
Yeah, I mean, I think this book was written in the white heat of the Me Too movement. And the issues being issues of who's telling lies, who's telling the truth, who is being manipulated. These things, in a way, don't change. So it doesn't really matter. I mean, it could be the early 19th century, but we're dealing with, I suppose, the old-fashioned idea of a novel.
Mm-hmm.
To investigate and dramatize and excavate areas of human weakness that are very easy, are very hard to find single words for. You can't say a character is bad or good or treacherous or, you know, awful, because it happens in slow time and people just do something they don't mean to do or cause the harm they don't mean to cause. And so, but the questions remain, who isn't telling the truth?
Aren't there variations of truth, though? I mean, there's a character called Nancy, and she does a couple of things at different points in this novel that I understand why she did them. I was judging a couple of them, not politely, but, and yet she's very smart. She's very smart, and I respect her. I just don't agree with her decisions. And I love being able to connect with a character on that level. You don't often get to do that, where you get to judge them and be like, oh, why did you? And at the same time, it makes perfect sense.
You know, one of my problems in life is that I never think fast enough, well enough. So this could be the smallest thing, you know, where someone has overcharged you, say, and you should just immediately say, no, this is not right. But you end up halfway up the street thinking, should I go back? Now, therefore, making Nancy at a very crucial moment of the novel make a decision that is so quick, so strategic, gave me pleasure, because I'd never do that myself. And I thought it'd be great if someone could do that, just to show what it's like. I mean, in one split second, she works out something that would be surely a year later she might have thought of. And she does it. And I gave, honestly, because I just couldn't do that myself.
But it really works for who she is.
She's a businesswoman.
Yeah.
She's a widow. She's had to start again in her life. So she's constantly making good, small decisions.
Yeah, I'm smiling just thinking about it, to be honest. Yeah. But again, watching these different generations of women, whether it's, you know, Francesca and Mrs. Lacey, or Nancy and Eilish, or Eilish's daughter, Rosella, who is going to have a very different trajectory from all of the other women.
Yeah.
It kind of sums up the world we're in and how we got here just through these women. And also Nancy's daughters are their own interesting women.
Oh, yeah. They really insult in the way that children in the 70s could, saying, your furniture. And the mother says, Nancy said, well, sure, there's some things. No. But every single thing in this room, out of this room, you know, you're talking about heavy 50s furniture. We know we've got magazines. You see, color magazines were coming into Ireland. Yeah. And everyone was seeing these rooms, you know, where instead of wallpaper, you painted cream or white. And you had this sort of spare, austere, you know, honestly, it wasn't Swedish furniture, but it did make a difference. And everyone changed their main living room in these years because their daughters came home from Dublin saying, we can't live like this anymore.
But Nancy's daughters, too. I mean, we've got the one wedding. We've got the other daughter who doesn't live, and then we meet the in-laws, Nancy's in-laws, who you've made it pretty clear they're from a very rural town, and there's some singing that happens at the wedding. I mean, you're playing with class.
Yeah.
So many different ways.
It's not class as much as country and town.
Okay.
It might
okay.
seem like the same place to an outsider, but okay. These are people from a farm.
Okay.
And they live in a remote place, and they just dress differently. Their hair is different. So this is the joke. Sometimes you think, don't put in this joke, but there's one I couldn't resist where because Ailish is back from America. So everyone's trying to think of something to say to her about America. And at the wedding, one of the in-laws, the people from out the country say, oh, yeah, where's the relation went to? She used to send dollars, but my mother didn't know that you could change them in a bank. She just thought they were nice to have, but she didn't realize that you could bring them in and get our money. And then, of course, by the time she found out she'd lost them, she couldn't find them. I don't know why. I made this up, but I just thought, I was a little thing about how remote places were in Ireland. People just didn't know that you could change dollars in a bank.
But this is one of those lines that you slip in throughout the novel. And certainly, you've done it in other books too, but I'm going to stick to Long Island in this particular case. But you give Eilish these lines of dialogue. A couple of Eilish's brothers show up, Jack and Martin show up, and they each get like a little line. Or it's, you just slip these tiny details in, and it stops the reader, and you think, okay, now I have a bigger piece of the landscape based on one small piece. And I sort of feel like there's more dialogue the chapters are shorter, but there's a lot more dialogue in Long Island.
There's an awful lot more dialogue. There's a moment where Tony, he's his husband, and he's one of the brothers, and they all, live in this enclave, but his father every Sunday gets one son to sit beside him at the sort of dinner they have, the lunch, and he tells the same story every Sunday. And it is that his own mother, meaning Tony's grandmother, coming from Naples, south of Naples, to America, was turned back because she had some problem with her eyes that they thought was a contagious disease.
Right.
And they sent her back. And she would never come again. So that her husband stayed in America, her children were in America, but she stayed behind. And I just thought that would give you some sense that Tony's family is also isolated and maimed in some way. So you have this strange idea of America. Each person is a result of three generations back, of some strange breach, some strange, moment that was not necessarily, sort of happy emigration and everyone felt good. That's not what it's been like.
Some of this self-containment, whether we're in Ireland or we're on Long Island, these families, these communities, is it fair to say that there's a little bit of John McGarren's influence sort of in the back of your brain? I mean, certainly not a direct line per se, but this idea that like it all starts with the language, everything starts with the language, and then it sort of ripples out from there. And it's less about your experience as the writer creating it as it is letting the thing breathe. Am I interpreting that right?
Yeah, in some way, but I think there are other ways of looking at that. John McGahern was an Irish novelist born in 1934, so he was 20 years older than me.
Mm-hmm.
And for a few good years where we hung out together a bit, and I went to stay with him and I saw him, and of course I was reading him because those early novels of his, especially with The Dark and The Barracks, but then a later novel called Amongst Women. And what he made clear was, I do not come from Ireland. I come from a very particular small place with some field and a house, and maybe some trees, and maybe a river or a train line nearby. And that is my terrain. That is my nation. Rather than talking about big questions of Ireland versus England or nationalism, you move you move your camera in, you zoom it in more and more on a single room, on the way the furniture is configured, and you go over and over and over it. And you can bring it into any number of books. And it often is an enclosed community with certain people isolated, where love is sort of weaponized, or love often comes in a way in the guise of, or some things come in the guise of dislike or confrontation, but actually are love. And you can't really distinguish between them. And also the small matter of ritual, of Catholic ritual, of the going to the cathedral, after going up to communion, after walking back down, after going to the pub, after going to the train, after going to the boat. So that I did from him learn quite a lot about how these matters might be treated. And in a way, we came from the same sort of background.
Mrs. Lacey also has a lot of ritual in her life. I mean, just going to the shops. And when Eilish realizes that she has bought her mother a refrigerator, and her mother is not thrilled about this, because she has a whole way of doing her life. And the refrigerator actually would make things complicated in a way that she would prefer. And yes, ultimately the refrigerator comes in, but watching that interaction between mother and daughter, it's more than just mother and daughter, though. It's also cultural.
Yeah.
And again, you cut it out of all of these tiny details.
I mean, it's hard sometimes. You have to think, this is 1976, and the mother has no telephone.
Right.
People did not. I mean, I'm telling you, as a matter of fact, people living in such a house would not, in 1976, in Ireland, have a telephone. We didn't have a telephone. And the fridge came late because people just like, why would you need that? But, you know, because you don't have those very hot summers, but none of the people didn't have fridges. I mean, they got one in around that year. And the same went for washing machines and dishwashers and all. Dishwashers much later. So, you know, it's quite important to remember that this is not America, you know, and that trying to explain not having a telephone. Yeah, that's correct.
But this changing world, right? And I'm going to sort of drop back into the Age of Innocence for a second, because it is exactly, in a way, what Wharton's doing, right? Like, you've got the push and the pull of the past and the present. You're starting to dip a toe into the future, but we don't quite know what that looks like, even though, I mean, obviously the reader would. But this idea, right, that there's a, in a way, a contract between, say, you as the author and me as the reader, where we know more than your characters do, and that's where a great deal of the pleasure comes from.
Yeah.
And I love that idea that there's a through line from Wharton to you.
You see, that's there also in Conrad and James, as well as Wharton, that idea that those, the novels of those years were filled with the idea that the reader really was enjoying the books because the reader, something one of the characters didn't know. But The Age of Innocence is interesting because it's really written, as my novel is, about 50 years earlier.
Right.
And in other words, it's published around 1920 and it's really set in 1870. And of course, it's looking at a world that I remember. 1976 is probably the last year I'm fully embedded in the town. So I know that the teachers began to drink in new sort, that the teachers were looking for an old pub, not a new modern place. You know, where were the teachers going to drink? I mean, the people who were working as teachers, the young teachers, the young lawyers, the young. So there's a whole set of things in the novel that the barman's daughter is getting piano lessons, you know, but he doesn't have a piano. Mm-hmm. And he wants, you know, to get guitar. All those tiny things are but there's also, of course, the sort of changing ideas. For example, people do need fridges now in a way that Wharton will describe as sort of New York that's growing, that's moving uptown. He sort of ironized that idea, you know, people don't know this is about to just happen, whereas, you know, 50 years later, it has happened. Yeah, so you're playing with those ideas of social progress and of a sort of great change, which is both Long Island and Enniscorthy.
With the title, Long Island, I think there are going to be folks who are a little surprised that you take us across the Atlantic. Is Eilish at home anywhere right now?
Yes, she's brought up her children in Long Island.
Okay, so Long Island really is home. It is home, okay.
That living room, kitchen, upstairs, that is her house. And that is where her life has been. But it is that idea when she really, it comes up all the time, where I used to be in a choir in a Catholic church, what about 89th Street on the Upper West Side of New York, which was filled with Irish plaques, Irish names. And I said, the priest came in and we were talking. I said, where did all the Irish go? And they always say the same thing. Oh, they went out to Long Island. and you would ask about another group, you know, where did they, like, the group that were in Brooklyn there, where did, oh, they went out to, and that business of going out to Long Island as though that was the next move, you know, that you wanted to go somewhere where you had could have a garden. And then, of course, reading the whole account of Robert Moses and the design of Jones Beach and the creation of facilities, you know, the public idea of this, that you would make a great beach for these people. So they could all drive and have their parking spaces and they would have their Sundays and the photographs of what that meant. That's all an idea, a sort of platonic Long Island, which is not the Long Island of the Gatsby. It's not any of that stuff. It's the Long Island of people could get cheap houses on greenfield sites with where they could have gardens and they could have put schools and all that sense of people just moving out of cities. But it's a funny word because it comes up so much. We say, oh, no, they went out to Long Island. They went out to what? Went out to Long Island. And so, yeah, that's what Ailish did. She moved out of Long Island. It isn't as though she, you know, yes, she goes back to Enniscorthy. But, I mean, it isn't as though you could call the novel Enniscorthy. You know, this is the newness. This is newness. And this is where she went. And it's funny because with Brooklyn, someone pointed out to me how little of Brooklyn is in Brooklyn. In other words, she's an immigrant. She isn't seeing that the, you know, there's a great club there and there was an amazing baseball game. She is so, in a way, surprised by the entire thing that she stays in her room. You know, and a lot of immigrants will tell you the first 20 years, they didn't see the country they were meant to be living in. And so that's part of the irony around it, the title Brooklyn, that it was a Brooklyn she barely saw. She wrote home saying she was in Brooklyn, but it's the same with Long Island in a way that it has been for her a suburban house. You know, and school and somewhere to work. It's not filled with local color. I don't do local color.
You don't do local color, but I will say when we're back in Enniscorthy with Mrs. Lacey, with Grandma, there is a slight claustrophobia that I felt because I'm definitely an outsider in that community, but there's a claustrophobia just from the level of gossip and that everyone really knows your business. There were a couple of moments where I was just like, okay, wait a minute, all of you people, please get hobbies. And then I realized, well, of course this is their hobby, making sure they know who's where and what, you know, this is just life. And there were a couple of moments where it felt a little relentless.
Yeah, in Nora Webster, the nun says to Nora, it's a small town and it will guard you. And to some extent it does, but yes, the Irish community, but Jim, because of the bar, Jim hears everything.
Right.
And because of the two barmen who work for him, he hears even more.
Right.
And then Mrs. Lacey is moving in the same streets about four times a day, stopping everyone to talk to them. So all sorts of news is being picked up all the time from a number of small streets. For Ailish, this is completely strange. So that's just, yeah, that's it's a very, very confined space in the way that Long Island isn't. You know, that there's no, all she has in Long Island is her mother-in-law looking through the window and her sister-in-law. The town is a living force, and there's nothing can be done about that. I mean, you can't pretend. You have to use it. If you try and neutralize that, you really are forcing the color down too much.
For me, the silence and the gossipy piece, the two. I mean, the Enniscorthy that I've experienced through you and through both Brooklyn and Long Island, certainly, I don't think you can have a place that doesn't feed on the, you know, people's silence, I should say. It's not like the community is quiet, but I mean, people use silence sometimes like a weapon, sometimes as a useful thing. But the idea that questions can be described as abrupt when, you know, you're really just trying to get to a point. But no, I mean, more often than not, someone will just ask a very simple question. Like, well, that's very abrupt. I'm not going to answer. Or simply, it is simple. There's a line in Brooklyn, I think you have, where Eilish realizes she's going to America because her mother and her sister have simply stopped talking about it. And she's like, oh, they've already decided. I'm going.
Yeah, that's how she knew.
Yeah. And we have strings of that here and characters puzzling out bits, but also the gossip sort of keeps, it's the engine running below
Alice doesn't want her mother to know about this initial scene of the novel that this man has come about Tony and Baby. She's just, it's too much for her. And if your mother starts to go, her mother will never stop talking about it. So Alice has a really good reason not to tell her mother about it.
Right.
Problem then is that her mother really realizes there's something. And then, of course, Larry, Eilish's son, arrives, and Larry can never see her. She's a complete nuisance. She's one of those kids, you know, don't ever tell Larry anything. And she knows.
He's 16.
And she knows to bring Larry down on her own and get the whole story out of Larry. So that's how, you know, that's how the news gets worked out.
It's such a satisfying novel, Long Island. Even for the moments where I was, you know, conversing with your characters in the margins of my galley, it's really satisfying. It's really, so much happens, and it's really tightly written. I will say that. I mean, it's very tight, not even 300 pages, right? Or around 300 pages. I mean, it flew. Yeah. It still feels a slightly different experience from my previous read. I mean, certainly, you know, Thomas Mann, let's take Thomas Mann and Henry James and put them on the shelf for a second. Yeah. But if I look at The Blackwater Lightship, which is a novel I love, Nora Webster, another novel I love, the pacing and the purpose feel different in Long Island than the earlier works, even if you're in a similar terrain, right? Because obviously Lily Devereaux shows up for a moment in Long Island, and I was quite pleased to see her because it had been a minute. But what changed for you? I mean, it wasn't just writing this in sort of the shadow of Me Too, but something is fundamentally different in the work.
First novel, and this is the 11th novel, but it's the first novel in No One Dies.
Ah,
and I didn't
okay.
plan that, and I only realized when the book was finished that there's no actual death described in the book. So something new then, that's a big change for me, because a woman in Australia, once I was signing a book for her, and she turned to me and just said, how many people die in this one? You know, in other words, that books became associated with that. In this one, nobody. And so we're dealing with really that idea of plot, that every single thing is an element of plot, that we get the action, we get the consequences of the action being worked out, and almost nothing else is allowed to happen in the book that it doesn't, in a way, come from that and attempt to resolve that. So you don't have, you know, a trip to Dublin for no reason where all of them go and you just learn something about the character on the trip to Dublin. We cannot waste time in this book, which in other novels, you know, Nora Webster learns to sing.
Right.
You know, Nora Webster goes to see her aunt, you know. No, you can't do that. That's not going to work here. It's a different sort of book. It's an effort to write a sort of 19th century novel, a plot. And therefore, you don't have the freedoms that you would have in, say, The Blackwater Lightship, where you could have a whole chapter where they're just discussing, you know, anything at all, or where, you know, Helen's going down to the beach and just looking at the sea and just thinking about what it means. You can't have that. That each thing has to move inexorably towards what you're working with conclusion. So it's a very different sort of book. And I don't think I'll do it again, because, you know, if you contrive it, because it is a contrivance, a book like that, where you're constantly moving. This has to fit in here because this has to come next. She has to know this now, but not that. That you, if you tried it a second time, it would look like a bag of tricks.
Yeah, and a bag of tricks is not you. That is not you. There is no way that would ever be something that you wrote. But, you know, we hit an hour. I knew it was going to fly. I knew this was going to happen. And we managed to not drop a single spoiler.
No, that's true. I told you the first three pages of the book. The rest belongs to the reader. So thank you very much for managing that, because it's quite hard.
Long Island really does belong to the reader. It is fantastic. This book, I cannot wait for it to be out in the world. There is so much to talk about. There is so much to think about. There is so much to have feelings about.
I know.
You can have your silent characters.
I know.
You can have your people pondering all of these things, but, you know, 21st century reader over here.
Has characters that can hate.
Oh, they're great, though. This cast, everything about this book. And I mean, when I'm sort of picking at things, it's because I had huge feelings about it, which is exactly what you want when you're reading a book, is to have all of the big feelings. And it's just a delight. I mean, this whole Yeah, the whole reading experience for Long Island was just spectacular. So thank you very much, Colm Devine, for this book.
Hey.
Have you started working on the next thing, though, before I let you go? Because I know we hit time, but...
I have a book of stories almost written.
Okay, great.
I write two more.
Okay.
But all the rest are done. So I'm going to concentrate on that short form for the next while, see where that takes me.
Excellent. I can't wait. Thank you again. This was so much fun.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Poured Over is a Barnes & Noble production. To help other readers find us, please rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts.